Show. When I need a little sanity and a little common sense, I go to my friend Jack Cashel to give me something in this crazy world. Thank you for joining me, Jack. How you doing?
I'm doing well. All things considered, considering that I still feel like a character in a science fiction movie, like an extra, and not knowing how the plot is going to end, So
I don't think any of us do, but you've been for a very long time. You wrote a great autobiography. You wrote a great biography on Obama that really disclosed a lot of what was going on with Obama. You really delved into the culture wars. You did a lot of work on obviously the BLM stuff, the George Floyd stuff. So here we are now in this situation where the law and order in our country is totally upside down. The Justice Department is totally, I don't know what is going on there. Where are we in terms of law and order in America and what's happening to our justice system?
Well, you'd like to think it's kind of bottomed out. Maybe it has. At least, thank goodness. I mean, I'm a silver liner. I look for silver linings and, things could be worse, what if the Republicans hadn't taken the House in November, however tiny a margin? We already know a ton more than we would have known. Like watching the FBI whistleblowers hearing or, the Durham report would have come out in any case. But that was the report itself and the reaction to the report tells us way too much about the state of American journalism. And that's where I lay the real burden and the blame. Governments go awry. They will always go awry if there's no one watching them and telling them not to. And as we saw with the reaction to the Durham report, our media are lost. They're totally lost. They've lost their way. I don't see, other than some guys like Matt Taibbi and, Glenn Greenwald and a few people, speaking out. Even Robert Kennedy spoke out on the subject. That's where we need the reform. And boy, I think it could cascade because most of these people are cowards. Most of them are waiting to be told what to say. So when Jake Tapper comes out and says the report is devastating, before he got his memo, they piled on him. Like, how dare you tell the truth? Meanwhile, all the dominoes are falling in behind him. CBS, NBC, CNN, NPR, blah, blah, blah. Oh, no big deal. Ranging from nothing burger to sedition, or we've heard this before. Or yes, the FBI made mistakes,
But we've reformed since.
Right.
Of course,
Japan
they're
made
now
mistakes
still going
in bombing Pearl Harbor, right? the 9/11 terrorists made a mistake by attacking the World Trade Center.
But that's why when it came out and I read it, I immediately emailed you to come on the show because you have actually covered a lot of these cover-ups that then you report on it. Nobody else is reporting on it. And then years later, then they report on it when it's way past the time of when people should have been paying attention. And you've dissected over the years a lot of these cases before they had to tell the truth. And that's why I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, what is Jack Cashel thinking when he's looking through this Durham report?
Well, I found that, first of all, I think the people who dismiss on our side, who dismiss the Durham report, do Durham an injustice. The media, the mainstream media were saying, the Republican conservatives are waiting with bated breath. No, I had forgotten about it altogether. Most people had. They hadn't been paying attention. I had been following each of the trials, the Danchenko trial, Fritzinson. So there wasn't that much new, but it was all put together. And it put together in pretty strong language, enough for any sensible person in the media to at least back up and say, what have we done wrong? We chased this, phantom for at least 3-4 years, and we owe someone an apology, but we're not getting that. Well, I have an article, Mel, up this morning on American Thinker titled, For Obama, the Cover-Up Was Worse Than the Crime. And this is, based on there are two adages that came out of the Watergate hearings. One at the beginning was, what does he know and when did he know it about Nixon?
Right.
Thanks to the Durham report, we know what Obama knew and when he knew it.
Right.
That is on August 3rd, 2016. if Brennan's notes are to be believed, he told, Obama, Comey, et cetera, about what Durham calls the Clinton intelligence plan. And that was the plan to create a false conspiracy between Trump and the Russians and pin it on Trump. And, you know, and that was shared at the August 3rd meeting. At least right. Brennan says so.
Yeah.
And Brennan is, he's totally devious, but I believe him here, you know. Although here I have to, you know, be a little skeptical.
Yeah.
What I focused on was the second adage that came out of Watergate, and that is, was the cover-up worse than the crime? And they said that about Nixon. Right. And in retrospect, by the way, and you know this, Watergate is a piffle. It's a trivial thing.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a footnote in history.
Right.
But it shows you what can happen when the media, you know, turn all their focus on a crime. And there was a crime, a real crime in Watergate, and that is the break in the Watergate headquarters, the DNC headquarters at Watergate, which
right.
compared to what the Clinton administration, Clinton and White House Clinton had done in cahoots with the FBI is a trivia. And so then the question becomes, was Obama involved in a cover-up? And yes, he was. We know this from the various other notes that, you know, because when I wrote Unmasking Obama, I focused on what did Obama know? How was he involved? And so I have that resource to go back on. Well, the meeting's on August 3rd. On August 5th, Peter Stroke, the FBI guy who opened up Operation Crossfire Hurricane
yep.
about 4 days before the thing, and who's a total scumbag, let's face it.
Oh, really
and,
bad.
And his mistress, scumbag mistress, Lisa yep. Page. If a female, can it be a female be a scumbag?
Yeah, or I believe so.
Scumbagette or something.
Now you can be anything. Let's just say
women have broken through the scumbaggery barrier. You know, now they're right up there in scumbaggery.
Yeah.
But a little, here's a little side note, a total digression, having to do with the origin of the word scumbag. You know, I grew up in New Jersey, but I commuted to high school in New York City.
Right.
And at that time, I didn't even know that phrase, scumbag. But in New York City, it had become the term of art for the word that we would use today, a word I never liked, was asshole, right?
Oh,
I mean,
really?
It meant the same thing. But it was a New Yorkism at the time.
Oh.
It was limited geographically to New York. Now it seems to have spread.
Yeah. It's perfect for them.
2 days after the August 3rd meeting in which Brennan shares the Clinton intelligence plan, Stroke is upset. He says, he quotes a bigwig. I think he meant Brennan. He said this. He wanted the FBI to have this project, and he had been told this is the White House's project, so stay out of it. Right. Yeah. A month later, Lisa Page texts Stroke,
right,
and she says to him, "The POTUS wants to know everything." Right, POTUS, President of the United States,
Obama. Right,
right. So we know that he was fully engaged in this whole.
Right.
That he could not have known. And so then they continue in this conspiracy, basically.
Right.
Obama wants to give the illusion that he has clean hands. So, and the great hand-washing lotion was provided by Susan Rice in her famous memo to herself, written on the day of the inauguration, during
right.
the inauguration.
Right.
But she is recounting the meeting they had on January the 5th in the White House, in which she said, President Obama wanted to make sure this was all done by the book. She
right.
repeats, we did this by the book. Well, in the meeting is Obama and all the other Brennan, Clapper, Comey, right. Susan Yates, acting AG. And they go over again what would think would be the Clinton intelligence plan. Except that now it is morphed into the Putin intelligence plan.
Right.
Which is what they call it, the Putin intelligence.
Unbelievable.
Plan.
Yeah.
And then on the 6th of January, again, Obama's a lame duck now. We got 2 weeks left. The intelligence community releases the intelligence community assessment, which is written like by one of my high school term papers, you know, just this and that. You know, you got 2 hours before
right.
did this. Exactly. I'm sorry, in college. I was still doing this in college. Oh, I have a term paper due this morning.
Right, exactly.
So you're grabbing bits of this and bits of that, bits of this. And they make these extraordinary claims about how Putin personally ordered his minions to collude with the Soviet Union, blah, blah, with Trump campaign to make sure Trump got elected and Hillary wasn't elected. You know, this goes out on January 6th. That same day, no, 4 days later, rather, BuzzFeed publishes the entire Steele dossier. This is all before Obama leaves the White House under his direction.
Right.
Clearly. And yet now when we read the Durham report, we find out some other interesting tidbits. And that is that the Russians were colluding with Hillary.
Hillary, right. Unbelievable.
This is probably, the Steele dossier was probably, and Durham suggested strongly, a Soviet, I mean, rather a Russian intelligence disinformation campaign.
Yeah.
They wanted Hillary to win. They didn't want Trump to win.
Right. Right. Of course they didn't. And the truth of the matter is that all of it is there. The question that remains is, why did he at the end recommend no criminal charges? But what I'm hearing is that we don't, that Barr, actually Bill Barr, that set it up, put constraints on him. And we won't know until he testifies, at least. But to me, there's tons of criminal charges available, which Devin Nunes, we know, put in long ago. And then what's crazy is, after it came out, Weissman, who we know is behind the scenes in the Mueller report as the main lead, struck Chalupa, you know, all these characters that were in and out all the whole time are writing McCabe, writing tweets and stuff that, like, no, it's Trump is an asset of Russia, you know, facts. Trump is an asset. I mean, go, like, just doubling down, like, all that work that Durham did is not right. What we said originally is right, even though that it's all laid out for you. So it's like we're in this post-truth world, and a lot of these people are straight up criminals. I mean, the problem is that Trump won the election. He's sitting president. They didn't stop from that day. They continued for till 2020.
Right. And that's, in a sense, why what Obama did was far worse than what Nixon did.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and because what he did is he set out not just to win the election for Hillary, but to destroy the Trump presidency after he was inaugurated.
Right.
You know, if it weren't for the handwritten notes by Brennan, it would be hard to pin this stuff on them. But, you know, the question that I had been reading the Durham report, and I don't even think Durham can answer this, is when did the Clinton intelligence plan become the Putin intelligence plan?
Right.
So, you know, when we know that they're meeting on January 6th, we know that they're having these other meetings on August 3rd. And we know that from his handwritten notes that Brennan laid it out in front of him that that the Clinton people had created a sort of a Trojan horse here to blame this whole thing on Trump.
Yeah.
So when did they ignore all that? How did they just move that out? I'd love to get a hearing
when that really happened. Yeah. And we also know that Uranium One was never even dealt with at all.
Yeah, right.
And now they're saying, what I heard today from a couple different places that I tend to look, is that after Biden won, a lot of the Clinton evidence was destroyed. Now, I know the two Clinton whistleblowers that have been dealing with the IRS for 5 years, they still have all their stuff. But there was an investigation into the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Global Initiative, which, mind you, also Jeffrey Epstein apparently helped create, never mentioned there.
Yeah.
But now what they're saying is that after Biden went into office, a lot of the Clinton evidence was destroyed by the FBI, which to me is just like, I mean, what are we living through?
I mean, the amount of skullduggery here.
It's crazy.
Is astonishing. I mean, you can't even write a book on this. You would need a multi-volume report. And I don't know how confident we can be that history will correct it. Certainly not the current crop of House historians.
Oh, my God.
John Meacham and, who are, they're historians the way, I can't even think of a good metaphor. They're so bad. They're stenographers for the Democratic Party.
But you know, Jack, what's so disturbing, and you've been covering all of this for now decades, what's so disturbing is that it's a right or left issue, is that people that, you know, hate Trump are fine with all of this. They were fine with the E. Jean Carroll decision, which is so insane. If you have a son or a husband or a father and think like, could that happen to my kid? Could that happen to my dad?
Yeah,
that should have been enough. But people were so excited, the Trump haters. And, you know, Jen Psaki has her show. She goes on there cheering. He's a sexual abuser. And like what they were saying it was a kiss on the cheek that was unwarranted. I mean, crazy stuff. Then this. I mean, I would think just as an American citizen in general, put aside Donald Trump, you'd be outraged that we have people in our government that are this devious, that are this underhanded, that are you know, basically everything that they've painted about the KGB or all of this is we're worse. They did it to us. And it's not it should be a universal outrage. And I can't believe how divided we are, that because it's Trump, it's okay.
Yeah, I share that. I mean, it's, you would think there would be at least some reckoning.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, let's say you're a reporter for the Washington Post and you won a Pulitzer for getting everything wrong.
Right.
I mean, not since Walter Duranty got a Pulitzer for covering up the Ukrainian terror famine. Have the media been rewarded for being so horrible. Far off? Right.
So bad.
I mean, so you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror and you think, what am I going to do today? You know, who came in second that year? You know, who was the runner up? What did they report on? You know,
isn't it amazing? You would think that some of those people would have by now. Now, to Beebe, you know, Glenn Greenwald, there's certain like left liberal journalists that have totally come at least to the middle to just be honest with the disaster it was. But the vast majority, especially legacy media, you know, and then they're cheering on the it's not a surprise that Tucker was exited out when he was with all that's happened since. And and it's just amazing to me that there's not more people that have a conscience and integrity and want, at least in the future, for people to look back and say, you know, when that person was when it was exposed that they were all wrong, that they didn't take the high ground. It's just shocking to me that no longer is something people think about that have gotten to this level in journalism.
Well, I think if nothing else, though, Mel, Jeb Bush was even upset about what they did. I mean, the soft right has come to understand what we on the sort of more observant right understood a long time ago, and that is that the media establishment has become laughable. I mean, it's not, bias is not even a word worth using. It's utter total corruption.
Yeah.
Utter total betrayal of their mission. And I hold them even more responsible than I do, you know, the sleazeball politicians
in
a government.
That's not their job. Their job is supposed to be working for us, to be skeptical, to be looking at the government. That's why they have the freedom of the press, is because the press is supposed to be working for us.
Yeah, you know, did you read that report done by Jeff Gerth for the Columbia Journalism?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I shared that on my newsletter, too.
I read the whole thing. I mean, it's long. It's 20,000 words long, but it lays it all out. And it, as though he wrote it for five people and no one else saw it or talked about it, you know?
No. The journalism school of record. You would think that would be a big deal to all the people graduated from there.
At least they gave him the space. I mean, that, if nothing else. But, you know, I'd love to be like a fly in a wall in a journalism class now. What are they teaching them? You know?
I can't even imagine. Because I got a journalism degree from NYU. And I mean, I just remember it was like, I felt like they were constantly like, you didn't give enough evidence was always the thing. Like, or you didn't have enough sources. Or it was always like, well, can you prove this? I mean, it was before it became full on Marxist. In the early 90s. But I have to tell you, it was such a different world. I don't know what they're teaching now. They have to be teaching some kind of propaganda. Of course, the professor there that I took propaganda from was exited out, Mark Crispin Miller, because he taught a class in the beginning of COVID on mask propaganda on both sides. And I believe he still hasn't gotten another class again. So they're teaching something that shouldn't be taught, which takes me to something that you have a book out right now on Tenable about the so-called white flight, which isn't what it was. But then I'm reading yesterday, the last couple of days, that the NAACP put a warning for Black people not to live or go to Florida. And I'm thinking, what is where are we? And I thought of your book because I thought everything was a lie about that. And you lay it out in your book. You kind of explain what really happened, how it was, what untenable meant.
Right.
So they are taking kind of your thesis and putting it on the whole state of Florida.
Right.
Like, what do you make of this total? It's so crazy.
Well, you know, the fortunate thing is, again, I'm a stupid Pollyannish about various things. When I see them overreaching, I see people like DeSantis and Trump and other people in the Republican Party saying, stop taking NAACP seriously. It doesn't deserve it. It's just another interest group, just a stupidly self-destructive. There are places Black people should avoid. Chicago.
I agree.
Washington.
Right.
St. Louis in my state, Kansas City. That they should stay out of inner cities everywhere. Right.
Yeah.
They should go to places like Florida, other than in places, you know, inner city Miami or whatever, where
right.
they'll be safe, you know, where they're not going to be murdered in a nice suburban community. They could go to the villages and
right.
and out and it's in the town square. And,
right.
right.
Yeah.
But they're not that way. And so then you see incidents that are so revealing, like the bicycle incident in New York City, right?
Unbelievable.
And you know, you talk about it. Explain it to the viewers who may not know.
So what happened was a nurse that just worked like a very long shift takes the city bike. So what you do here is you have an app, you hit City Bike, it gives you the number, tells you where to get it, you pay for it on the app, you go get your bike, you put in the number, and it unlocks the bike. As she's unlocking the bike, five kids that, you know, were there, they were five Black kids, she's a white nurse, she's pregnant, mind you, she's pulling at the bike, they say that it's their bike. And she says, no, it's my bike, showing the thing that, you know, it gives you a receipt on your phone, she had the code. And then they start to harass her, whatever. And then one of the friends catches it on TikTok or whatever, and it's shared. And she's demonized as a racist for stealing this kid's bike. I mean, it was just, it's so ugly to watch, especially knowing that she's a nurse coming from a long shift. She's pregnant. She had the receipt, but the media ran with it. It was so shocking to watch them run with it. Twitter is such a cesspool, but I mean, and it was a lot of white, you know, liberal journalists being like this racist Karen.
Yeah. And
totally a lie.
Benjamin Crump.
Reading of course.
Charge, right?
Our best friend.
Benjamin Crump tweets out that not only that she's a racist, but she's a thief, right? This is a woman who's conspicuously pregnant, who's hormonally, you know, off balance, surrounded by five large Black kids.
Right.
We're trying to steal the bike she's just paid for.
Right.
You know, $1,200 fee.
Right.
If that bike isn't, checked back in.
In an hour.
And all you had to do was, and she's saying, and a bystander says, just put it back in. And then whoever wants it can pay for it. And then it's a neutral bike. Because if you put it back in, you neutralize the sale.
Right. Yeah.
I don't like the idea of city bikes to begin with, but that's, you know, the price you pay. But she's clearly in her scrubs. She's pregnant. How could you even think that she is trying to steal a bike from a Black teenager, right?
I mean, it's so crazy, but I mean, that's where we are. It's also, I feel that way about knowing what goes on the New York City subways. I haven't even ventured onto a subway. I used to take them every day since COVID because it's so dangerous down there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's the Wild West. And I mean, there's homeless people, mentally ill people that they're not taking care of. Of course, you should see right now what's going on in Midtown Manhattan for the illegals. Of course, for all these years that I've been talking about the crisis of mental health and homelessness, and Bill de Blasio had an $850 million program, his wife ran, all the money disappeared for them. Right now, 50% of the hotel rooms in New York City have illegal immigrants in them that are getting all these benefits from New York City. And I'll tell you, I feel for that Daniel Penny.
Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, I've been on subways where you can't make eye contact right now on the New York City subway, or something could happen to you. I don't go anywhere near. I haven't been down in a very long time, but people stay all the way back near the stairs because they're scared. Sure. Once you get in there, and it's always been this way, always during Giuliani, when I was young and in college, it was cleaned up. But the last 8 years, once you get into the subway car, the odds of you being harassed, either sexually harassed or for money, or, you know, somebody really like eyeing you or sitting close to you and intimidating you are like 90%. So, you know, for this guy too, I feel like, and I knew he was going to be arrested, and then the same thing, Crump, they come out, they have this big golden casket funeral for this guy, ignoring all of his crimes. Like you covered the George Floyd in depth. Seems very similar, same characters pushing it. It's very sad, very sad.
Well, you know, it's the, what is it that the expression goes, the history repeats itself. First time is a tragedy, second time is farce. This had reached farcical levels.
Yes.
They had a hard time getting that kind of George Floyd momentum behind this case, partly because Daniel Penny did exactly what you would hope any young man would do in that circumstance.
Been in that circumstance where I hoped it, you know what I mean? Where I've it's gotten that far with me, with a guy like pulling my bag and a guy stepping in and helping me. And I've been there on times when, you know, women are getting terribly harassed and nobody does anything.
Yeah.
You know,
if no one does anything, for instance, in Philadelphia, a couple of years ago, a woman was sexually assaulted for 40 minutes on a train. No one did anything. And then it was a disgrace. If you're a male in that position, you should be ashamed of yourself. You should be, that is, should be something you live with for the rest of your life, you know, a failure to act in the moment.
Yeah.
But Penny did the right thing, right?
And wasn't alone.
That train knew he did the right thing.
Yeah.
And he'll be acquitted. Even in New York City, he'll be acquitted. But when I look back at, comparing his treatment to that of Bernie Goetz in the 1984 incident.
Right.
For those who may not remember, Goetz was this kind of a nerdy engineering kind of guy, wore glasses, kind of skinny and bespectacled. He had been seriously mugged not too long before that incident. Right. So he started carrying a gun. Four kids came after him. They had sharpened screwdrivers.
Right.
They're hitting him up for money, and he shot him.
Yeah.
And you go back, and I would encourage people, just go to YouTube and look up Bernie Goetz. After that incident, he was treated as a hero.
Right.
Exactly. New York was a different place then. Blacks and whites said, those guys had it coming. Right.
Yeah.
This is before the Obama re-racialization of America.
Right.
When it was revealed that he actually shot one of the guys once he was down, the sort of the luster went off Goetz's mission. But the initial response was positive.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't be in somebody's head too at that time. I hated that part of the Bernie Goetz story. I always felt very bad, and people they didn't know about that. But here in this case too, the very other part of it is that they were presenting him as like a Michael Jackson impersonator, not as a violent 40-time repeat offender of this kind of stuff that, you know, was in and out also by force of the mental hospitals here, which is a joke in New York. My homeless friends, I have homeless friends they would never go to a shelter in New York City under any circumstance because it's too dangerous. They'd rather be on the streets. And I've tried to help these guys. There's no help for them. Some of them want the one that I see all the time and help a lot. He would never take anything from this city, but he's scared to go on the subway.
No, it's dangerous, right? For the homeless, really dangerous.
Yes, they're sitting ducks. He told me he's got beat up twice by gangs of teenage guys like that.
They were just easy prey.
Yeah,
Like the guy in St. Louis who got shot in the head.
Yeah,
saw that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen it. I saw it. Yeah.
In Kansas City, which is
interesting. This happens a lot to homeless. People don't know that. These two homeless guys, and the scariest part is they're putting up all these people in the hotels now, the Roosevelt Hotel, all these hotels. This guy in particular, he's a friend of mine. He's very smart. He's schizophrenic, but I know that he's very, very smart. When he's lucid, I can talk to him about American history, and he knows as much as I do. It's amazing. He's a very brilliant guy. Lots of problems. Won't go to the hospital. Won't get help. During the COVID, they put him in the YMCA, right? Mm,
yeah.
And within 2 weeks, He had his hair cut. He's all clean. He's doing art. He's showing me art on the street. When I see him, he's walking around. He was within 2 weeks of kicking him out. He was beat up by homeless. He was beat up by a gang. He was in and out of the hospital. I mean, it was, look, they can help people. They're just proving it now that they could have helped these homeless people all along if they wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a strange world out there, and it's getting stranger. And the, you know, I had lunch today. I'm working with a fellow. I do ghostwriting and editing for people. And I've done about 30 or so books. And I don't mention names or anything, but this guy is, let's just say, because he is, he's an immigrant to America. Very conservative, patriotic guy, right? And his observations on this are fascinating, you know, because he doesn't get it. As an immigrant, he is particularly appalled, given what he had to go through. He said he didn't have, you know, it's kind of fascinating because he got in, he has an incredible story, backstory. He was an imam and he converted to Christianity, et cetera. It's a long, involved story. But what was fascinating about it was when it was during the Obama administration that he had moved from trying to get a green card to become a citizen, right? And they held him up for 2 years because they saw some of his speeches in which he criticized Barack Obama.
Wow.
And like a lot of people who came to America seeking freedom, he's become increasingly concerned, freedom of speech particularly, that freedom is being taken away.
Yeah.
And it's hard to fault him on that. I mean, he told me today, he said, 10 years ago, if you told me that we would be losing our freedom of speech here, he said, oh, I said, you're crazy. That's not going to happen. That's why I'm here. That's why a lot of people are here.
Right.
He said, but now, you know, it's, and he blames it on Obama. You know, he seems that whole racialization.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's a person of color himself. And, you know, he's Mid-Easterner. I mean, so it depends on his relationship. So it's a.
Right. It's well, interesting. You know, you covered Obama's years pretty in depth. And we know that there's people behind Obama that I hear their language every day. Cass Sunstein, Norm Eisen, you know, all of Obama's inner circle, the whole Harvard law crew. And you can hear their voices in every single time that they put down another DHS list of things you can't say, or they're going back on the, you know, the whole like behavior modification through force or the Twitter files. I mean, it's the same group. The scary part is, you know, I talk a lot about that when Trump won, I feel like Blinken and Sullivan and all of them, all of the Obama people basically went to that West exec consulting firm and continued as if Obama didn't lose through the whole Trump administration. And that includes all the guys that worked on the Transition Integrity Project. That would be Eisen and Brock with the Democracy Matters and Podesta and all these people. They never accepted that Trump won, and they worked the entire time behind the scenes, but they also worked behind the scenes too. If you look at the David Brock, Norm Eisen, Democracy Matters document that they wrote in January, right after the inauguration to fight Trump, basically in the media, I have it on my website. It's a shocking document, but it goes through there with all the ways that they're going to censor, silence, smear, lawfare, impeach. I mean, they just write this thing out. They don't even care.
And they don't care.
They don't care. And it's still the same voices. When you read some of these memos that come out of this fake, it's not buying it, and is what I mean. Some of these executive orders or some of the things like warning of different language, it's the same exact wording of this same group of people.
As the Durham pointed out, the one FBI agent who texted after the inauguration, "Vive la résistance," right?
Right.
This is
was Kleinsmith who ended up changing the.
Right, that's right. That was Kleinsmith. Right, right.
Who should be in jail?
The one guy who got his wrist slapped, you know.
Right.
But you saw what happened with Sussman, and you saw what happened to Danchenko. You know, Trump got 4% of the vote in 2016 in D.C. So for every grand jury you see, there's going to be one Trump supporter out of 24 people. Out of every 12 people on a trial, one half of a Trump supporter, maybe. And these people are completely okay with jury nullification, you know? Right. The Scottsboro boys got a fairer trial in Alabama in the 1930s than Trump got in New York City.
Yeah. And also, the January 6th guys. I mean, I know those guys, a bunch of the ones that were Proud Boys. You know that they weren't, they didn't go in the Capitol. They didn't have any weapons.
Right.
This is all through text messages that there was at least 15 FBI informants or plants in these messages. And these guys are all pissed because they feel like the election was stolen. So these are personal back and forth. They got seditious conspiracy convicted of basically treason. They didn't even do anything at the Capitol on that day.
No, it's shocking. And I just get enraged, so enraged that I can't even bring myself to read about this stuff.
I cried that day. I couldn't
believe it. And it appalls me that so few people speak out about this. And I was heartened to hear Trump say that he would pardon them. And whoever the Republican is should, actually the Democrat should do it right now. Biden should do it right now. So such a total travesty, total miscarriage of justice. Miscarriage doesn't even do it justice. It's miscarriage just implies an accident.
Right.
Abortion is what is the right word here.
Right.
As far as justice is concerned. Yep. Speaking of incidents in Washington, what's your take on the van driver with the Nazi flag?
Oh my God. Isn't he great? Listen, they're just getting lazier and lazier. Like what are they? First of all, I think the guy's Middle Eastern or Indian, I'm not sure.
He drove
at a very low speed into that. And then not only did he have a Nazi flag, but they laid them out on the street.
That's so, right.
Well, and just like,
we're still waiting for the Nashville Manifesto.
I know, exactly. They're never going to do that. But here's the thing, like, this is where it gets scary because, you know, I'm sure you saw the ammonium nitrate that's missing from the West Coast out of, I don't know where that would go from the trains. And then we have this now white supremacy. You know, I have a problem with the 64% of white people in America allowing this storyline that has no backing to it at all continue. I mean, we had George Soros come out 2 days ago and say, like you said about the NAACP, I feel about the ADL. What a joke. Yeah. And they're embedded with the Southern Poverty Law Center. These people are all, they're just smear campaigns, lawfare institutions. They're all progressive left, a nightmare. But, you know, Soros comes out. Now it's white supremacy to even say anything about him, not anti-Semitism. It goes to a whole new level. So this whole white supremacy model, these people are getting so lazy in their false flags, not meaning it didn't happen, meaning it happened and it had a reason to happen, that I fear these people are getting desperate. I fear, and then I see that they're giving all satellite phones to the people in the Senate. And I know about like the cyber polygon thing. And I'm going to have Michael Yon on tomorrow, who's been down at the border being like, these are fighting age men coming through from Venezuela, from the prisons and all that, but also Chinese nationals all over the world. We are in a very precarious situation, and they keep doing these things with like the Patriot Front. I have a feeling that they are, and they want to charge Trump with insurrection. That's why I think that happened to the Proud Boys. What's your take on all of this and all of these pieces of the puzzle?
Well, yeah, I think I agree with you on a couple of points. One is that they are getting desperate. And the, you know, if you could do a word track, for instance, you could do this pretty easily. See the word usage by, say, the New York Times over time.
Right.
So you have a white supremacy, flat, boom, 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 right? Racism, boom. White nationalism, boom, you know? Just a thousandfold increase in the use of those words. In, you know, when we have an increasing supply, I mean, an increasing demand for racism and a diminishing supply, you have to hunt further and further to find the incident of racism. So what you take is the poor lady with the bicycle in New York, and you blow it up to something of where millions of people have seen this. And then so desperate are they. So desperate are they that the CNBC guy is questioning Elon Musk, a real African-American, by the way, about whether he's an anti-Semite because he called I compared George Soros to Magneto.
I know. And people are acting like it's a serious interview. It's right. And what's so crazy is that these people, I mean, they don't even seem like real people. I feel like maybe they already have the Neuralink. Like, how are people acting like this in real life? And for me, I just, if there was just a few people, I feel like if just a few of these people just said, you know what, enough's enough. I'm going to just start, you know, calling things as they are and not as right. I'm being told. It could change things. But right now we have, they just keep double, tripling down that the coven that I call the View is saying that, well, you don't have to be white to be a white supremacist. And people are like, that's true. Or there's yeah. all these people going on, like we said, the NAACP, but, you know, they're having segregated graduations at Berkeley. And that's not only at Berkeley, all over the place. Right. They want this so bad. But again, I feel like the Black community loses because they are not the majority. And now we have things like where they're not going to have MCATs or LSATs to get into medical school or law school. Right. You don't have yeah. to pass your law boards, your medical boards. What are we? This is such an insult. And then they make it like it's because of white supremacy and systematic racism. It's like, no.
Well, you know, and in fact, you're highlighting the left's greatest vulnerability, which is right now the notion of intersectionality is held for the last dozen or so years. Obama was really good at holding all those elements in the multicultural rainbow together.
Right.
So, in fact, I was talking to my friend today, who's a former imam, and
right.
I said, "How do you find because he likes to infiltrate the left. People don't know him well enough to know, and he looks like someone on the dark side of the Mideast, and so he could go any place and infiltrate."
That's great. We need more of that.
Yeah, right. And I said, "Okay," and he was telling me how his perspective on, he spent some time in Washington, is that on the Democratic side, gays and Blacks are the ones who are controlling everything now. They're calling the shots, right?
Right.
And he said, and I said to him, okay, how do you reconcile this? The gay lobby wants to have parades for gay people, right?
Right.
The Muslim lobby, which is part of the whole intersectional coalition, wants to throw gay people off buildings. How do you compromise? What do? You throw them off buildings and have a net to catch them and then you celebrate them? I mean, where's the middle ground here? You have these disparate elements that cannot stay together forever. Right. And Blacks, you see, and I know we've seen these false hopes before, are beginning to catch on.
Yeah.
They're going to lose out. They've already had to give up their opposition to their Christianity to accommodate gay weddings, et cetera.
Right.
They've turned they've ignored the border crisis for a long time because right. their leaders told them to. Now they're showing up in their neighbors in great numbers,
yep.
taking their jobs, threatening their children, hanging out on their streets, and they're beginning to wake up and yep. say, we saw this in South Shore, Michelle's neighborhood in Chicago, where there's a major protest.
Yeah,
that's where. In fact, when I did my book on California. In 2006, what's the matter with California? I said, this is the real fault line here. In California now, Hispanics outnumber Blacks at least 5-1,
yeah.
right? So you think Hispanics are going to want to queue up to pay reparations? No.
And but besides, none of the money from Black Lives Matter went to Black middle class or Black impoverished people. It went to Act Blue. And now what they think the reparations money will go to them, they're just using the Black community over and over. I honestly believe, here's why, here's the main problem too with going into 2024. I feel like legal immigrants and Black middle class people who went through the last about 4 years from Black Lives Matter to now get it. Or at least way more do than didn't before. A lot of also, right. I get a lot of emails from gay people that do not like the transgender BS. They don't right. like what's happening in schools. They don't like this with kids. And they don't like that their movement that was successful was hijacked. So we have a lot of people that I think, and these are probably the people that are polling good for RFK, on a lot of these people. But the truth is, that they have to cheat in 24. And I saw KT McFarland talking about it. God forbid Trump gets in there and actually has another opportunity. It's going across the board. But I do fear that people are, either they're going to do something to not have the election, or, you know, I just, my biggest fear is that they get their one party system and then that one party will not be even recognizable in the United States.
What's your take, Mel, on the RFK candidacy?
I think that they will destroy him before he gets too far. But I do like his voice in there because it is forcing.
However bad his voice is. But
I know, exactly. No, no, no. But I do like what he's saying. Right. But, you know, they're never going to let him get much further than this. And like I believe, I think Joel Gilbert's right. They're going to march out Michelle Obama as soon as they can, probably around October. If not her, who knows? Hillary's talking about Joe being too old, so she'll probably try again. But I mean, RFK, they're going to destroy him, is what I think.
They will. And yet I love that he's in there. Right?
Me too. And I agree with a lot of what he's saying. I really do.
I mean, there's a lot wrong. He's got a long way to go. I wrote an article about this, but where his failures are. I mean, if he applied the same analysis to climate change that he did to COVID, I could consider voting for him. Right now, he's not there. And if you have if you're the head of a thing called the Children's Health Defense, and you're not even talking about abortion, you know, where you're kidding yourself.
Right.
He's got some things he's got to reconcile.
I agree with you. But I do like some of the things he's saying. And I'm not a big fan. I've talked about, you know, I think the real coup happened the day they killed JFK, and they've just been covering up everything else since so that no one ever uncovers that. So,
well, and RFK has got to be concerned. I mean,
I know. That's why I'm saying they can't. I don't think they can assassinate him like they couldn't General Flynn or Donald Trump, because it's too hard now to not get caught. But they will do whatever they can to shut him down. I just like that his voice is there. Now, before I let you go, we got to talk about it. Nobody has ever seen anything like the persecution of Donald Trump. I mean, I truly believe it's helping him, but it's got to be hell on earth to be him right now.
You know, he's probably gotten used to it to a certain degree, and he could pay $5 million without worrying about it, but it's obscene. And it has two effects. One of them is good, and that is it makes even the Jeb Bushes of the world see how unjust the system is. The other is bad for him in that people get weary of that, you know, and a little bit sticks every time. And so many of the things that he's been accused of are a little bit tawdry. He may or may not be guilty of in some way. I mean, meanwhile, Tara Reid can't even get her voice out. But
no. And Bill Clinton was on Epstein Island 27 times, provably, and never been questioned by anyone. And that doesn't even come up in the conversation.
We know his real history, too. The Juanita Brodericks. We know Hillary's role.
Like seven women. Juanita, one of them.
Right. And Hillary's role in hiring private detectives to threaten these women, kneecap them, whatever. We know all that. They don't. So if you ask 100 Democrats who Tara Reid is, they wouldn't know. I mean, if you ask them, you know, there's many questions you could ask, and they simply wouldn't know. They don't. They probably, up until last week, they didn't know who John Durham was, you know? So the ability of the left media to conceal major facts from their audience works, at least for the time being, into their favor. But I don't know. I think that the Trump is, I'd like to see him as president. I think the competition, Republican primaries, very healthy, and DeSantis is obviously going to offer that.
Right.
I like to see Tim Scott in the race, even though he's not going to go anywhere. But I mean, I'm happy to see a competitive race.
Me too.
The more people in the race, the better it is for Trump, actually. But
I agree.
And on the Democratic side, their rigging of this election be the third straight primary.
It's already rigged. Done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's scary. It's scary for me. As far as Trump, I just have never seen it. I can't imagine that our country, left or right, I can't believe there is a left or right dynamic anymore. I mean, I'm like full on listening to old George Carlin being like, see, he's like, this is where we are. But I have to say, they're going to try to put Trump, that Jack Smith is a very dangerous situation. They're going to try to put him in jail. You're seeing Bill Barr, who obviously was always not for Trump, and even Ty Cobb come out. Look, they want to put this guy in jail because they can't take him out any other way. And it's going to be a rough road ahead. But I honestly feel like, you know, we'll see what happens. But it's a very dangerous road ahead. But thank God there's people like you out there writing several columns a week to kind of keep things in perspective. Because if you don't, either I feel like too many people are checked out completely and they don't even realize where we are or what's happening. And the ones
I encourage everyone I talk to stop. That you're all potential producers today. All potential. You can go on Facebook and influence 10 people. Do it. You
know, I agree.
You didn't have that opportunity before. I have, you know, myself, I have a book coming out in July, so I'm going to be focusing on that a lot. Untenable, by the way.
Yeah. I know.
Real to true story of white ethnic flight from America's cities. And every time I you know, what I'm doing, and I'm writing articles and to support the book, some of them about the book, some of them not, but I unearth phenomenon that no one's talking about, like white flight 2.0.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, you're aware of this living in New York City. The big cities, the big blue progressive cities are hemorrhaging millions of people.
Yep.
Overwhelmingly white, right?
Yeah.
And yet the media not only do not call attention, any attention to the hemorrhaging, but they never apply whiteness to it, even though the numbers are far greater than they were, you know, back in the original white flight days. Because they're the ones fleeing. Right?
That's why I think your book is, you've done this with about five different of your books, where when you write them, they're relevant. But as time goes on, they become more relevant. I would actually suggest to everyone right now with the Durham report, they go back and read your book about Obama.
Yeah.
Because it really does tell you a lot of what's going on here. And he held on to that idea that he was scandal-free to such an extreme. And it was such a lie. And we're still dealing with that lie. And he was out there this week talking about that the biggest problem is the divisiveness in news, and that we're living two different realities, and that his reality is the real reality, you know. And you prove that 10 times over that is not the case. It's not the case.
You know, I went back, in fact, and reread my section on unmasking Obama and the whole Russia thing. And
yeah.
And this is written in 2019. There wasn't much I missed. It was all there. You know,
books.
Right. The intelligence, the Inspector General's report was out. The Nunes report was out. This information, you know, 8/10 of what Durham was able to present was already out there. Durham just put it in a package that was digestible. And I applaud him. I know that people were skeptical and whatnot, but he was.
I think we don't know what his rules were. I kind of think they let him keep going under the guise of you're not going to file any charges. We don't really know the terms on him continuing the investigation after Biden came in. That's what I'd like to see. When Devin Nunes was on my show, he said that he hoped that they held it until after 2024, because if anyone was charged now, that Biden would just pardon them. Yeah. So, you know, that's a thing, too. So, you know, we don't know, but I do know that as soon as your book comes out, I want you to come back on. And it's amazing how relevant now Untenable is yet again, right when your book's coming out, because, you know, people need to know that they got to get out of the inner cities. And the reason is not what you think. The reason is because it's untenable.
Yeah, right. That is the reason. But hey, Mel, I really appreciate what you're doing. And you, I mean, you always actually encourage me, because it's what I like coming about on your show is that you, I sort of like myself, are a happy warrior.
I am.
You gotta be. I mean, let's face it. No matter how much things suck today, right?
Right.
We are living in we have spent our lives in the best time, in the best place in the history of the world, right? You know?
Yeah, and you and I, you know, and the great thing about you and me, and there's like a small group of people I listen to and talk to, Kunstler's one of them too, we're all kind of observing it from our own kind of perch. And then when we get together and talk about it, I think my audience, especially your audience, all these, I think people just feel relieved that you can still take a step back and not let it destroy your data. That's what people have to do, is they have to, you know, love what they have around them, be good in their lives and their family, and keep going, or it can destroy you. I mean, there's so much demoralization. You and I still find a way to have humor.
I have to have it. And let's face it, you watch a KGP press conference, but they're funny, you know.
I know. I laugh way too much. It seems wrong, but it's just, it's like you said, You couldn't write a movie about this. Nobody would believe it. And you'd need like 10 volumes of books. But I do know you. And I know that someday you will write about this period of time and it'll be a classic. You'll need some space.
I'll need a little space, Mel. Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
Thank you so much, sir. Come back when the book comes out. The book coming is Untenable. Cashel.com. Go over there. He's got everything going on. How's the podcast going? Are you doing it?
Yeah, it's great. If anyone wants to check it out, it's just go to Upstream Podcast.
Great.
And we're now on all the major Spotify, YouTube, Apple, all those places. So check it out. We're having fun. But thanks, Mel. And we'll be back. Okay.
Yeah, you will. And thank you so much. I love your voice. And I'm telling you, your columns, and everyone should follow his columns out there. He's on many different platforms. They always keep me in perspective and a little more stable. Because, you know, you have a good way of cutting through the crap, and I appreciate it so much.
Thanks, Anna. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye. Hey, Patriot pals. So happy that you're looking into gold and silver and protecting your savings for whatever comes ahead. Beverly Hills Precious Metals is our good friend, and we've been working with them for a long time. So you'll be getting a call from them. We'll also follow up here at the Mel Kay Show because we want to make sure that you're taken care of and you're protected. If you have any questions, please let us know. Right now is the time. There's so much information coming. There's so much chaos. We just want all the patriots out there to be sure that they are protected, they are moving forward, and that we get through the storm together and safe. Whatever may come, just know we, the people of the United States, will prevail. God wins, and protect yourself. And please get in touch with us if you have any questions. So Beverly Hills Precious Metals, they're the best. They'll be in touch. We'll be in touch. You be in touch with us. Let's do this together.